Welcome to The Space in Between. The Space in Between is a place where I dive deep into the vexing reality of today's often polarized times and find ways to navigate the complexity of leadership, evocative current events, and do so in a way that helps us stay in a place of high agency, hold firm to our convictions, and also bridge divides. Hi, I'm Lee Morgan, and welcome to The Space in Between. Authenticity is having a strange moment. Most of us want this from our friends and colleagues. We want to be authentic in the world. Polls tell us that voters want leaders who, quote, tell it like it is. And yet, authenticity can sometimes be tricky to define and also to express. Some people are called authentic even when they are chronic liars. Others who might experience themselves as being authentic are judged as too careful, too polished, too emotional, or too angry, or, quote, not quite enough of whatever version of themselves society decides to judge. And I think these dynamics matter. They matter all the time, but I think especially now, we are living through a time of a lot of disruption, low trust, and a lot of political fatigue. I know I feel that way. And too many people don't feel seen or heard. And sometimes we just want to crawl under a rock. And the hunger for leaders who feel, quote, real can be very powerful and sometimes even a little dangerous. Today, we're going to dive into all of this. And we will ask, what do we actually mean by authenticity? And how do the identities that we carry and express in the world influence how it comes across and is judged? And what does this have to do with our sense of agency, a democracy that we're trying to nurture and make better, and our capacity to repair and renew constructive civil discourse? Y'all know I care a lot about that. And today's guest, Maya Rupert, is exactly the person to help us explore all of it. Maya is an author, political strategist. She is a former presidential campaign leader. Take that in. That's a big deal. And she's a podcast host whose work sits at the intersection of race, gender, power, and democracy. Her fantastic book, The Real Ones, How to Disrupt the Hidden Ways Racism Makes Us Less Authentic, examines how identity shapes our ability to show up as our full selves. So she has some pearls of wisdom to drop today and a few practices that will help all of us show up authentically regardless of circumstances. Maya, it is so glad to have you. Welcome to the Space in Between podcast.
Truly, thank you so much. I'm so excited about this conversation.
Me too. And we met, I think, in 2009 when you were, back in the day. We thought it was polarized times then, and look at us now. But
oh my goodness.
I know, crazy. You were a political director for a great nonprofit called what is now called the National Center for LGBTQ Rights. And I remember your vigor and really exceptional leadership in that organization's advocacy efforts.
Thank you.
Yeah, and it was inspiring then. And your book now has expanded on some of the themes that we were working on then, and certainly in the political realm. And so my first question is, where does your passion for work in politics come from?
Honestly, it comes from living in the world. And I think it comes especially for living in the world as a Black woman, as somebody who holds marginalized identities, as somebody who tries to act in allyship to other communities and movement. To be in that space is to recognize that politics is not something that can be a spectator sport, that you've got to get in it. I feel like there are ways in which, as I was discovering what my identity was, the fact that it was sort of a politicized one, I learned those things at the same time. For me, that was always just sort of a deep piece of who I was as I was discovering who I was.
I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it's a very profound concept to actually acknowledge the complexity that we are, and that we grow and we change and we have multiple identities. And yet, at the same time, when I walk out of my door and you walk out of your door, we face and deal with different social conditions based
Yes.
on perception. So this is where multiple things can be true at the same time.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're highlighting, is that we live in a day where we have complexity about our identities. I think that's what you're saying. And yet, to acknowledge that without also saying social conditions still exist that are very reductionist, like as if you're only a Black woman or as if I'm only a
Yes.
white woman. We are way more than that. And yet, those identities, when we walk in the world, they actually do have an influence on how people
Yes.
experience us and how we see the world.
Exactly. They have a huge influence. And so I think that sometimes, and especially when we think about authenticity, one of the mistakes that we make is we kind of flatten it. We try to say that there is a real you and that it exists somewhere almost in stasis. And the journey of authenticity is like uncovering it. It's peeling away all of the external stairs that might make you be someone else and like figuring out who you are at your core. And that imagines a world that is not the world we live in. It imagines that there existed a real us that existed separate from anything else. And what I argue is that that's not true. And it's especially not true for those of us who learn to ask the question of who am I at the same time we are having to ask the question of who do I need to be? If you were conscious from a young age of the fact that there was a dominant gaze that you were not a part of, if you had an identity, gender, sexual orientation, race, socioeconomic class, if you learned early on that people are going to be looking at you to confirm or deny a certain set of stereotypes, and that part of this, the question of how you're going to show up is a question of how you're going to respond to that, then there is no me that existed before the stairs happened. The stairs have always been a part of it. It's part of how I constructed myself. But so, to your point, if we kind of look at our lives as though we walk outside and we're just one aspect of our identity ever, that's not true. But it also then it can have the potential to ignore the fact that the perception in a lot of ways dictates exactly like the question that we're struggling with. Like authenticity is not just, do I feel congruent? It's, am I perceived as being congruent? And that means it's not just my personal inquiry. It is, how am I being perceived by the world?
Okay, this is so rich and it's very complicated, isn't it? Because
It is. It's, yes.
I think you're saying agency is not an individual virtue. It's something that we express at our best to be our full selves, right? So
Yes.
yay, we walk out
Yeah.
the full selves and we want that for everybody. We actually really do.
Yes.
And at the same time, the social conditions, where we're born, how, what our skin color is, ethnicity, language, what accent we have, all these things, not one, but many of them also really influence how we're judged of being authentic. Did I get that right?
That's, I think that's exactly right. And I think what you're, I mean, look, it is complicated. And I think part of why I wanted to write the book was to complicate it. It was less to solve a problem and more to present a
Well,
more
we love that on
complex
this
one,
podcast. So
right? It's that,
you're in the right
yes,
place.
this is the space in between, right? It's, we talk about authenticity like it's this uncomplicated good. Of course, you want to be authentic. And of course, I, as your friend, want you to show up authentically. But it's, what are we actually talking about? Is it, I want to be authentic because the psychic stress of having to live my life as somebody who's not really me is a burden I shouldn't have to take on. That's important, but that's only important to me. When we talk about authenticity as you should be an authentic leader, or voters want authentic candidates, or anything where we're talking in the more like we're talking about a broader thing, what we're really talking about is a collective good, but we still somehow treat it like it's an individual thing. So we say, oh, I don't feel like you're being authentic. So that's a problem for you to solve. And a lot of times it's not. If I don't perceive you as being authentic, that incongruence might very well exist in me. And a lot of times what we see is that when you don't define a term as important as authenticity, but as big as authenticity, a lot of bias seeps in. So if I think you're being inauthentic, it might be because I don't know a lot of people like you, and you don't conform with what I expect you should be like. And that's about me. It's not about you. But we place that burden on the other person and go, be more authentic. And so often that other person is someone with a marginalized identity, because very often what we're really saying is, I'm not used to seeing you in this role. So make me feel comfortable with how you're showing up. And so that's the piece that I want to solve. And when we think about it, when we think about it in politics, we think about it in leadership, we think about it in culture, we are asking a burden of people that isn't fair for them to have to hold.
Talk more about that because I think this is so important for all of us. And let me give you an example of Pete Buttigieg, right?
Yes.
Who ran for president, who I think it's fair to say many people across the political spectrum find him to be thoughtful, compelling, smart. He's
Yeah.
comes across as kind of folksy. He uses words that most of us can relate to. He does spend time showing up on Fox News, right? He's one of the, and he would identify more in the liberal spectrum. And he's gay, he's married, he has a family, he's this lovely man. And I'll tell you what, if he was a kind of a flamboyant gay man, I think there'd be a really different reaction to him, right? He's kind of this Midwestern, earnest, former army guy, right? And so for me, that's an example. And what's interesting is he's not a person of color, right? He's
Right.
almost meets a normalized version of a
Yeah.
boring white guy who happens to have certain charisma and skills. And then
Right.
we see your candidate, Julian Castro, who ran for president, great
Yes.
mayor, San Antonio, very capable secretary of HUD. And you know, whether he didn't get out of the primaries, but arguably just a really solid candidate, right? He gave it a try. He had a great campaign leader, but he might be judged a little differently and held to a different standard. Can you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's really fair. And I will say this, I think very highly of Pete Buttigieg, and I have no reason to believe that the ways that he is sort of he presents a version of a gay male identity that I do think for a lot of people was possibly more palatable than if he were, for example, single, or if he were less gender conforming, or if he weren't white, or if he weren't from the Midwest. What he does is presents for a lot of people, I think, as it's sort of you're only challenging one thing in my mind.
Ah, right.
It's a very, in
Yes.
a lot of ways, doesn't challenge a lot of people's preconceived ideas. And so I think there was an ease of the fluency that he was able to capitalize on. Now, I say that very lightly, reminding everyone right now that we're on the heels of him describing having had someone call CPS and accuse him of putting his children in danger, which is such a disgusting thing to do, and so very clearly coded of something that you do with queer men. That is a very specific type of accusation, and we all know where it comes from. So I'm certainly not trying to say that he does not deal with some of these
That's
exact
right.
same dynamics, but there is a fluency that he is able to adopt with an ease that it would be much, much harder for candidates of color. And I think Julian did get compared a lot to Pete Buttigieg, to Beto, to some of these in 2020. It was such a big field. And, everyone was sort of saying, okay, well, kind of what are the lanes? Who do you get compared to? And I do
Yeah.
think that, Pete Buttigieg and Julian Castro, both, mayors in red states who ran blue cities, there were some similarities. They were young, they were telegenic. And there is a difference, I think, in the way that a Latino man was being read by the electorate. And I think one example, I talk about this some in the book, but I can go into more detail with it. But one of the things that would frustrate me so much is how much the white guys got praised for their ability to speak to white working class voters. Pete Buttigieg, I remember, went on Bill Maher and said, he talked about how Democrats had lost their way with white working class voters. And, he's from Indiana and was able to say, like, look, I live here and this is what I see. And this is what people, and it was, people were like, oh my gosh, that's what Democrats need, right? Our first policy proposal that we put out was on immigration. And that made sense. Donald Trump was making anti-immigrant sentiment a cornerstone of his campaign. He continues to do that today. And he saves an extra level of vitriol for immigrants from the southern border. Leon Castro is a second-generation immigrant whose grandmother came to this country from Mexico in the hopes that she would raise a daughter who would raise two sons who are doing exactly what the Castros are doing today. They are that American dream that we talk about, right? But his decision to put out a policy on immigration, he went on Bill Maher as well. And Bill Maher called it pandering. He said, well, that would be like if Barack Obama put out an affirmative action plan. It's like, we know you've already got them. And I
So
was
annoying.
seething to this day. I'm like, it was so, because I could not believe how no one, there was no language to point out how ridiculous that juxtaposition was.
Yeah, because it's very reductionist, isn't it, to like our opening
Yes.
conversation of because this is you're a Latino that I can see
You are
right
the
in front of
brown guy,
me.
so you can't talk about the issue that's relevant to a community you're a part of. But we look at the white guys who can speak to the white guys and go, that's great. That's what we need. Meanwhile, yes, we're hemorrhaging white working class voters as Democrats. We're also hemorrhaging Latino voters. So the idea that these things got treated differently didn't have anything to do with how authentically they both spoke about the issues. It didn't have anything to do with how honestly they came to them. It didn't have anything to do with how relevant the issues were. Julian was the first person to put out an immigration plan for an election that ended up being, that was one of the most salient issues people were dealing with. But because he was Latino, he was held to a different standard.
Okay, this is great. This is such a, I think you're just bringing to life these very complicated and very real dynamics that, in one sense, he was being authentic to himself on an issue that was relevant to the entire country, that
Right.
was a dominant theme in an election that many candidates were thinking about. And yet, when he led on his policy proposal, he got reduced to you're the Latino candidate who's talking about that issue, rather
Right.
than it's an issue that impacts many, many people across multiple identities, right? So this notion of
Right.
authenticity, it's so, I mentioned it before, it's tricky. And so everybody just read a book and you'll figure out, or just keep listening because we got it right now. I would be remiss to not also highlight another dominant figure in our culture, which is Donald Trump.
Yes.
And how, since he was first elected until now, there's so much feedback we're getting through polls and focus groups that many people who voted for Trump don't like him, maybe are vaguely aware of his policies. He's a fantastic communicator, okay, in polarized times.
Yes.
And the guy is often referred to as being authentic.
Yes.
You know, it's like his calling card. I'm like, well, I don't like him, but at least he's real. At least
Yep.
he's being authentic. I even heard someone say, well, he gets things done. And I thought to myself, have you paid attention to what he gets done? And again, I will let you know there are folks who have voted for Trump who listen to this podcast. So we're not gonna,
Absolutely.
what I'm not intending is othering or putting down people who voted for him, just highlighting an actual reality that a sense that this man is authentic. And how do you explain that?
I have such a hard time explaining it because I've heard the exact thing. I've heard it from people who say what you will about him, he's authentic. Donald Trump, I think even people who like him admit that he's a liar. He lies a lot. He says things that are untrue. And then later he says, I didn't mean that. Or, someone says, well, what he really meant was. And there are probably some things where he's genuinely misspeaking and he's just sort of allowed to misspeak and it gets cleaned up later. But there are times where he says things that are, we know that they are untrue. But somehow he still gets read as authentic. And so there's a question, can you be an authentic liar? Can you be an authentic con man? Because this is what I feel like we have to do. When people say, well, but I think he's authentic, ask the second question. What do you mean? Because the second question very often is where the rubber hits the road with authenticity, because we kind of use it as this proxy and then it bakes in a bunch of stuff. And so you say, well, what do you mean? A lot of times, what people will say, and I'm just sort of like grouping it all together, but some version of he's unscripted. It's not that he's not, okay, fine. Yes, I don't believe what he's saying is true, but I know he's saying what he, that wasn't poll tested. No advisor told him to come out and say that. He is saying it because he wants to say it. Either he believes it's true or he believes it'll work, but he is saying, I'm getting him unvarnished. Okay.
So authenticity is unvarnished, and for some reason, there's a desire for that.
And that's the question. Why do we want that? I look at somebody like Kamala Harris, who got a lot of criticism because people said that she was inauthentic. Because Kamala Harris uses talking points, she stays on message, she's hyper disciplined. When she goes on, she says what she was supposed to say. And people would read that as a lack of authenticity because clearly that was prepared before. Clearly that's what her advisors are smiling, his advisors are cringing. That's my measure for authenticity. But when Kamala Harris misspeaks, there's a question of whether or not she knew the difference. There's a question of whether or not she, well, wait, did she say that because she didn't know? Did she say that because maybe she's not in those meetings? Or did she say, she doesn't get the same. Donald Trump's statements get cleaned up a lot in the media. People call it sane washing. He can say something unhinged, and then the next day, in the name of sort of fairness and not looking biased, the media puts forward the best version of arguably what he could have said. But with candidates like Kamala Harris and ones who operate a little more normally, they don't get the benefit of that kind of after the fact cleanup. So they get asked, oh, she gaffed. Did she mess up or did she not really know? When she goes off of her talking points, it's word salad. Should she be here? And those differences have to do with their identities. Donald Trump gets read as presidential when he misspeaks, when he says things off the cuff, when he meanders throughout things, when he makes promises he won't keep. Because we have an image in our head of what is presidential, and Donald Trump fits into it. And Kamala Harris doesn't. So she is not just proving that she's the best candidate. She's proving the unspoken question of, do we read her authentically as someone who can do this job? And because there are so many more limited boxes for how we can put her in there, she already has a bigger thing to ask. So when we say, I want someone who's unvarnished, on some level, we're saying, I want someone who is comfortable enough that they know that if they think say things off the cuff, they're still going to be read as qualified and deserving to be there. I'm asking for the person who's never really been asked, do you deserve to be there? And that is going to be a question that is easier for white men to clear than it will ever be for anyone else. And that's the part of this that I feel we don't notice, and we don't do it intentionally. I'm especially amazed by it when someone who says, I don't like Donald Trump, I would never vote for Donald Trump, but say what you will, he's authentic. I'm like, I don't think you realize how much easier you're making it for Donald Trump, but more than that, how much harder you're making it for candidates of color and for women of any race to get to that point.
I think this is so prescient for these days because on the other side of this argument is focus, and it comes out of more kind of right-wing political orientations of being woke, right? Of, oh, you're just blaming,
Yes.
the that, oh, so you're doing the same thing to white men. You're stereotyping white men. They're putting them in a box as if their white maleness is the only thing that helps them get ahead, which can, and just at a very human level, if that's someone's felt experience, right, then that's
sure.
one thing. And so we have to deal with that dynamic as well. And I would posit that the argument you're making that I really, really resonate with is that there's a kernel for everyone, that we don't want this reductionist,
absolutely,
you know, pass, you fail up or you fail back, depending on your identity. Like, we just don't want that. But you're describing broad and well-researched trends of how unconscious bias work, how conscious bias works based on identities that we present in the world, not in a reductionist way, but just in a very common way that one's race does have an impact, not exclusively. It's not correlated of I'm a white woman, because of that, I'm going to make less than every white man. No,
right.
That's not how it works. But on average, we know that's the case. And we also know that if you're a black man driving a car and you're pulled over by the police, no matter how fantastic that police officer is, your chances of getting arrested or being harassed are higher than if someone in a different identity. And I think it's really important in the space in between to say, yes, we can hold right. all of this complexity.
Absolutely. And that's the thing I want people to walk away from this with, is that it's not as though because you're a white man, it's like, okay, well, then that's why you get elected, or that's why, like, it's not that simple. And it's not as simple as though there are no white men who are also struggling with the same question of authenticity in other ways. To the point about Pete Buttigieg, it comes out for him in different ways. I don't think it's true that simply because of that, that tells the entire story. But what I'm trying to point out is that it tells what has become an invisibilized part of the story.
Thank you. Yeah.
We don't talk about it. We don't think about it. We say authenticity is, it's equally good for everyone. And no, there are no differences. We're asking everyone to be authentic. But what we're not maybe realizing is that how we read authenticity is easier for some people than it is
yes.
for others.
Yep.
And I don't think that Donald Trump's demeanor could work if he were a white woman. I don't think it could work if he were a man of color. I don't think it could work if he were a woman of color. There are other things about who he is that would not be read in the same, say what you will, she's authentic. You don't get that same grace. And that's it. It's not that
yeah.
that was it. That is, if we just put up
that's
a
it.
White guy who puts, then Democrats would win. It's not that simple. But there's a part
that's
of
right.
this that just gets erased that I want us to bring to the forefront.
Well, we are bringing, I hope, bringing that to the forefront in a
Yes.
powerful way. You are. And thank you for diving into all the complexities. And, you know, one thing that we talk a lot about on the podcast is, you know, 20 years ago, we had divided times. You and I were in meetings talking about, you know, advocacy efforts. And yet fast forward to today, and we're in a hyper-polarized time. And we
yeah.
know that through our lived experience. We know that through research. There's more distrust in society now than ever before. And that's seen in political
yeah.
figures, even in public sector. And so given that it's hyper-polarized times, what's changed? Because I think the dynamics you're describing were relevant 20 years ago, 100 years ago, as today. What sense do you make of how polarization has impacted this notion of authenticity?
We are dealing with a situation where we trust fewer and fewer people. The polarization has really impacted the public trust, eroded it to the point that I don't know what exists of it, which means we don't have the same number of trusted messengers. We don't all turn on the same news. And when we even do hear the same news, we don't all believe it the same way. And that means I think there is an extra level of desire for what we read as authentic leaders, because we want to say, I am more inclined not to trust people. I'm especially more inclined not to trust people that I disagree with. So if you, leader, can get me to read you as authentic in a way that makes me trust you more, even when I don't agree with you, that's a currency that most people don't have. So I think it ups that need for authenticity, but again, it ups it in a very specific way. It only says, I need you to be authentic insofar as it makes me trust you more. So if I say, I don't like Donald Trump, but I say what you will about him, he's authentic. He gets the benefit of getting called authentic across the board, but he's not contributing to public trust. So again, sometimes we use that word and it gives the facade of the thing we're looking for. But it's not contributing to the thing that we say we wanted in service of. So again, I think that's why that extra question is important. Why do you want authenticity? Because
Why
I
you
want to
want.
trust leaders again. Well, do you trust Donald Trump? And if you don't, does it matter if you read him as authentic because he's being off the cuff? And so again, it's authenticity just. It contains so much that it makes it can mean everything to what kind of means nothing. What we actually need more than ever are people who are going to contribute to a public trust. And I would argue that someone who is unscripted but dishonest doesn't contribute to that public trust.
Well, I would agree with you. Surprise.
Right?
It's an odd dynamic. And I actually think throughout history we can see why authoritarian type leaders risen to power tends to be during polarized times when people feel very uncertain about their current circumstances, economically, socially, there's a lot of unrest. And it's not uncommon to see charismatic leaders who make it a part of their platform to say those people are to blame. I alone can fix this, right? So these simple platitudes, and that you're describing this very real dynamic that can feel authentic to people. And one of the things that I think is really important is how do we find a way through this, right? And so you've thought a good bit about that. What practices, what recommendations would you offer to listeners, right, who may not read your book, but say, look, what are one or two things we can do every day to strive to be our fullest selves, right? To walk out and be our beautiful, shiny, bright light that we are in the world, right? And do that understanding that we can have that choice, that agency of showing up as our full self, and also acknowledge we're in a world where social conditions do impact how I'm experienced. What are one or two specific things you would offer?
I would say if you're striving for authenticity for yourself, remember that it is an individualized pursuit. And so think about it in terms of you and how you feel that congruence or evenness in you. I think very often we place primacy on, well, this is what I originally thought, so this must be true about me. When I was younger, I wanted this, and then I let all these other voices in my head. So getting back to the true me is getting back to what I used to think. I would urge people to challenge that. I think a lot of times, what gets us to our most authentic self is actually having interrogated what we thought or what we wanted. Sometimes those initial bursts are also based on outside influences we just didn't know. So give yourself the freedom to interrogate desires, wants, who you think you are. I think we have this idea that sort of effort is anathema to authenticity. If I have to try to do something, it's not who I am at my core. A lot of times, the things that we try the most for, the things we strive for, are actually the things we value the most, but other things make it harder for us to get to them. So don't give yourself a hard time. If you think this value feels true to me, but I have to work really hard to make sure I'm getting to it every day, don't say that that means it's not authentic to you. Authenticity can involve effort. It can involve a lot of effort. And I think just sort of keeping those things front of mind is important. Then I would say, and it's a slightly different question, when we're talking about authenticity with each other, try to keep that same kind of grace. Remember that you don't know someone's internal journey. So if somebody is being read as inauthentic to you, ask yourself, what is it that you're responding to? Are you saying, well, yesterday you said this and today you said this? Does that mean that they're inauthentic? Does it mean they're inconsistent? Is there a piece of this that maybe matters to them that you're not understanding? Try to ask that second question, because a lot of times when we're calling someone inauthentic, what we're really saying is there's a piece of this that I'm not getting, and I'm letting my bias color whether you're being perceived as authentic or not.
You've mentioned the word grace, which I think is a beautiful concept here and not lost on me because in our body politic and a time of hyperpolarization, grace is a powerful way to diffuse tension. It's literally a word that kind of feels good coming out of your mouth, grace. And I want more grace in our public discourse. So I'm thankful that you lifted that up so powerfully.
Yes, I think there are very few things we can't get to if we can meet at the corner of grace and humility. I think that if we integrate those into how we interact, that very often extend more grace, even than you think is deserved in a moment, and you'd be shocked. And I think approach these things with the humility that reminds us all that there's a lot of things that we know for absolute certain right up until we realize we're wrong. I think there's a lot to be gained from those being the guiding forces in our political discourse. And I'm not saying I'm definitely a person of like, I'm not going to go into a room full of people who are questioning my humanity and right to exist in public space and go, let me find my grace. Like, I recognize that there are limits to that. There are
That's right.
places where that grace will not be met, and there's no value to that. If we don't agree on a fundamental, everyone is entitled to a certain amount of human dignity. That's not a political discussion even. That's like the goal there is not to get to an understanding. I can't compromise with somebody who's not willing to extend that to me. And so I would never encourage anyone else to try to do that. But I think there are many, many, many more spaces where we're not talking about fundamental human dignity or rights, that we're having discussions that, again, sometimes we use proxy words to mean a lot of things. I believe that there are values that I share with people who fundamentally disagree with me on things. And if I share a value with you, I genuinely believe we can come somewhere and actually we can get past what we're talking about and where we were. If I didn't believe that, I couldn't do this work. So I feel like that is the project that is before me right now, is figuring out where those common values lie and where I can bring people along, and especially where I can go into a space where someone else might not be comfortable extending grace because it's their humanity that's on the line.
That's right.
Maybe there's a space I can be in that someone else can't, and I would hope that someone else can go into those spaces where I can't. I don't think we get past this any other way.
Yeah, and that's what really good allyship is about, right? Where we aren't asking people, first of all, safety, basic needs being met, violence that occurs to certain people based on their identities. Like, we need to meet that basic level. And once we get above that, then this notion of agency, I think, comes into play. And you gave a great example of, for me, agency to step in this space in between, which we're describing, where we hold grace for ourselves and others. And then we have a self-awareness. I feel safe enough. I have enough emotional capacity to step into a place and maybe have dialogue and connect with someone who might be really different or holds a different viewpoint or different value, but I'm going to dialogue. The choice to do that is about agency. Another high agency choice is not now. Not now for reasons that I don't feel safe.
I don't feel safe. I don't have the energy for
No
this.
energy, whatever it is. And that's when you might look at a friend and say, like, you need to step in there, right? Because, and so the funny thing is, holding strong convictions, and you mentioned earlier there's a steadiness, right, of understanding what you care about, of where that is strong and secure. I think that's actually a platform by which we actually can hold that someone else's perspective might be interesting or that we could learn something.
Yeah.
But in today's polarized times, that can be tricky because we often get blame and shame for having strong convictions. And
yes,
I actually think your writing and what you've articulated about authenticity of it's complicated, social conditions matter. And yet that doesn't mean we'd stop agency around expressing ourselves in the way that we find to be integral to ourselves.
Right. Right. I think that's exactly it. And I think, gosh, figuring out how to do this and do it publicly and do it well is so, it's hard. It's complicated. And it's hard because you never want to make it seem like you're being an apologist for someone that is doing harm. And so if I go into a space and I say, well, I want to extend grace and I want to try to engage with you, and someone goes, how could you engage with someone with such hateful views? Am I now furthering the harm? And I think those are real questions, and there are things you have to sit with. And there are no bright line rules. And I will mess it up, and I think we all will. But I don't think that the answer is just not engaging. I don't understand a concept of justice that doesn't have at its core an ability to apologize, seek forgiveness, seek redemption, be held accountable, and recover. At its core, I think that's the process of justice. It's why I believe in restorative justice as the goal for any kind of justice system. Social justice is a part of that for me. I don't know how to engage in this work if there's no way to screw up, be held accountable, and do it better the next time. And I think we have to figure out how we get a system of public accountability and forgiveness that allows us to engage in social justice in a more productive way.
So beautifully put. I'm very inspired about that. That's the bridge, right? You're describing a bridge, accountability, grace, all of it. And it's hard to do, but we must support each other.
Yes.
And as we get near the end of our time, I have two questions for you. The first one is, what gives you hope these days?
I feel a lot of hope because I'm looking at, this is a really important moment. I really think that what has come out of, honestly, the destruction of American democracy as we know it. I think our next step has to be the restoration of it. I don't think we are at the let's save it. I think we are dealing with things that we never thought in our lifetime we would see. I believe we have an illegitimate Supreme Court. I believe that we have a broken, like I said, public trust, but that means our government has been dismantled in some really important ways. I think the media, the fourth estate, the incredibly important role it has historically played has been very broken. I think we have to rebuild our structures. And in a moment where you get to rebuild, it means you get to rethink. Everything doesn't have to look exactly like it did before. And I think we're seeing a moment where people are saying, hey, I don't believe anymore that it's a policy inevitability that people can't afford their lives. Wages should be going up. Prices should be coming down. Our politics don't have to center corporations. They can center us. I think people are rethinking the things that we said were just the way the system works. And that to me says there's a lot of room to grow. So I feel like as scary as this moment is, there's also a huge amount of opportunity.
I think there is an opportunity for great innovation. I also find it's a time of great connection amidst tremendous disconnection. And this conversation is just one of it. Your book has, and your work in the world obviously is a compelling force in that direction. And I would wager anyone listening right now probably cares as well about being a force for good, of rekindling, renewing, rethinking at a time when a lot is up in the air. And so last question, let's pretend you had Maya's magic wand and you, with that magic wand, you could, any wish that you had for listeners could come true. And what is that one wish you would like to leave listeners right now?
Oh, I hope that people feel unburdened by everything that we have said has to be true. I think the most powerful thing that we can do right now is say to the, well, we can't do that. Why not? Like every time someone says to you, like, well, yeah, but I mean, we can't make healthcare free. Why not? It's impossible to make sure that everyone who needs this will get it. Why? Why on earth, if we can acknowledge people need it, why can't we get it done? Because there are places we say that. Right now, if we said we need to go to war, there wouldn't be a question of, well, is there enough money? There are things that we say that's just, well, we have to do it then. Take all of your, well, then we have to do it, and apply them to regular people. Apply them to the young people in your community. If people are going hungry, well, then we have to fix it. People are sleeping on the street, well, then we have to fix it. Change how we see the inevitability of our system not working for all of us. And I think that you will see, it will feel like magic how we can see the world differently.
Maya, thank you for being on the show. This has been an amazing conversation. And thank you for lifting up this notion of rekindling and renewing, the notion of grace, and for helping me and listeners really understand how authenticity is something that gets expressed. It's certainly unique to each and every one of us, and it lands in a social milieu that makes it a little bit of a tricky concept, but that if when we stay grounded and rooted in what we believe and who we are, that's a cornerstone, that's a foundation for navigating the complexity of authenticity in today's polarized time. So thank you for your work in the world. Thank you
Thank
for making
you.
time. And I'm going to encourage everyone to read Maya's book and remind us your podcast. You had a beautiful podcast series, and where can we find that?
Yes, When We Win, it is still available on Lemonada. It is a limited series show that explored what happens when women of color run for office by challenging conventional wisdom and doing things differently when they weren't set up for us. So I got to talk to some amazing women who won elections by doing things differently. It was a really fun series. We got nominated for an NAACP Image Award for it. It was really fun. Still available on Lemonada. The book, The Real Ones, is available now everywhere you can get books. And I am online, Maya Rupert. You can find me on LinkedIn, on X, on Instagram, on Blue Sky. I'm kind of all over the place. So I'm around and happy to talk about these themes.
Maya, thank you again for joining us on the
Thank
Space in
you.
Between. Bye for now. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Space in Between podcast. If you did, please hit the like button and leave a review wherever you listen to the show. And check out the spaceinbetween.com website, where you can also leave me a message. Take good care.